ceremonies to draw near and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08708 et al. Delay an individual et al. Autonomy versus Titan Corporation. Ms. Burke, the appellant, Mr. Gilman, the appellate, Mr. Higgins,
Mr. Burke.
May it please the court. Susan Burke, and I'm representing both appellants in this matter. We are asking this court to overturn the district court's decision in favor of L3. The district court, in confronting the arguments...
I've organized my mind about the word Titan. Could you just... It's Titan,
certainly.
Correct? Is that right?
Yeah. Certainly, Your Honor.
Otherwise, you're going to confuse me.
Yes, I understand. The district court, in ruling on the arguments made by Titan, was confronting a very difficult task. No statutory law... No direction from Congress. Instead, he was in that realm of federal common law, a difficult thing for any judge. And he made an understandable mistake. Confronted with the voluminous record, he failed to keep circling back to the underlying reason that the Supreme Court issued its decision in Boyle. And that reason is to ensure that the United States, not any private litigant, but the United States, benefits from the court's application of federal common law. The district court, in ruling on circumstances that could never have been anticipated by the Supreme Court...
You're talking about state law here, aren't you?
What we are talking about is permitting claims made under state law to go forward.
Right, in the constitutional text, structure, history, Article 1, Section 10, which prohibits the states from regulating war, combined with two different lines of preemption cases, Boyle and Garamendi, all suggest that the states do not have a role in the constitutional structure in regulating the United States war efforts, at least absent congressional direction to that effect. Wouldn't this upset that entire history and structure?
No, Your Honor, it would not, and for the following reason. The war-making power of the executive is to decide when and how to make war. So we look in this case to what the executive has decided. The executive has spoken very clearly that in the war in Iraq, the Geneva Conventions are to apply. So the executive has triggered the application of the federal common law of war to the...
Again, we're talking about state law on this first claim, correct?
What we are talking about is whether or not to permit claims to go forward where the state law is looked to as the rule of decision. There's really two paths that claims could go forward either under federal common law or under state law. And the reason that the district court erred is that when you're trying to decide whether or not it makes sense to let the claims go forward under state law, you need to look at whether or not the state law is going to create a conflict with the federal interest. So when you look at the Supreme Court in decision in Boyle, the Supreme Court laid out three different types of situations.
Wasn't the Supreme Court interpreting a statute?
No, Your Honor. What the Supreme Court was doing was trying to decide whether it would benefit the United States to stop litigation against a private litigant. Obviously, the United States itself can invoke immunities. The United States' measure of the waiver of its own sovereign immunity is set forth in a statute. But the statute does not simply directly apply to a private litigant. Rather, the court has to step back and say, okay, as a matter of federal common law, should I bestow this private party, who is otherwise subject to both state and federal common law, should I bestow upon this private litigant a privilege that's reserved for the sovereign? And to decide whether or not a private litigant essentially stands in the shoes of the sovereign, the Supreme Court looked at what it is the sovereign wanted. And what the sovereign wanted is set forth in the immunities, in the Federal Tort Claims Act. And so the Supreme Court undertook an analysis and said, okay, there's three different ways this can play out. First, there can be a state law, the application of state law, that would clearly conflict with the federal interest. And in those cases, we are going to hold that a private litigant cannot go forward. The second cases are on the other side of the spectrum, and that was in the Murray case. There, the state common law, letting the state common law go forward, actually furthered rather than harmed the federal interest in aviation safety. That case turned on the fact that there was a a dump that was, there was a land that was under contract right near an airport. The people operating the dump said, well, we have a federal contract with the FAA. You cannot possibly bring us forward under state law. And the court looked at that and said, well, you know, let's look at this as a practical matter. If we permit the state law claims to go forward, what happens? It actually furthers the goal of public safety that is enshrined in the contract. Murray is the situation we have here, because the goal of the United States, enshrined in both the contract and in the executive statements, is that the conduct of a war by Americans is conducted in a lawful manner. And so the executive has...
Congress has had many opportunities to legislate in this field, and it has, in fact, legislated in the 90s, the Torture Victim Protection Act, the War Crimes Criminal Statute, the Torture Criminal Statute. Since 2004 and extending the UCMJ, but it has never, never created a private civil cause of action of the kind you're specifying here.
It's actually the opposite, sir. To shut down what would be the ordinary course of tort litigation, they would have to legislate against it.
The question, right? How do we interpret congressional? What's the default rule?
Right.
Right. Without a specific statement of congressional preemption. If you look at Boyle footnote 4, for example, which talks about certain areas of uniquely federal interest, and then you look at Garamendi and Zernig and that whole line of cases, which are really intertwined with Boyle, then you find that implied preemption in this area, in the war powers area of all, is going to suggest that there's preemption unless Congress affirmatively wants state law to apply. Isn't that right?
No,
you have areas like immigration, war reparations, the dispute in Zernig, all found preemption based on field preemption, not simply conflict.
Well, the reality is that you can never assume preemption for a private corporation, for a private party. You have to always go back to what is benefiting the United States interests, not the interests articulated by a private for-profit corporation. So
that's
one,
just an implied domestic preemption. That's not true.
Is Judge Kavanaugh correct? I read Garamendi as saying that there was a direct conflict and not using the field preemption. That's pretty express about that. That was in the Zernig case. Of course, if you look at Medellin, it goes exactly the opposite way. That is no preemption at all, notwithstanding express statements by the executive. What do you make of this Garamendi line of cases? Does it really stand for a proposition about field preemption?
I think that the situation that we have here, you do not have, as Judge Kavanaugh said, you do not have Garamendi extending that far. I think what we have here in this type of preemption is a very narrow type of preemption that is governed by Boyle. And since it is judge-made law, we have to read it narrowly. And so the question that really Judge Kavanaugh is going to is more, how broadly should we be reading the Foreign Tort Claims Act, the exceptions that are put out there?
How could ask the question that Judge Kavanaugh asked in exactly the opposite way, which is Congress has had many opportunities to give independent contractors immunity and has never done it. And in fact, the FTCA specifically exempts contractors from actions by the contractor, even with respect to government immunity. There's no statute that provides immunity here, is there?
No, and in addition to the fact that there's no statute, no discussion from Congress, no statement from the executive, it's important that the United States has not intervened.
Well, there is a doctrine of implied preemption, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's well-rooted in American law, correct?
Well, the actual parameters of it...
Correct, are debatable.
Are debatable. So, of course, the doctrine itself is there, and right.
And as a matter of first principles, maybe implied preemption as an entire doctrine is a little in tension with the usual judicial role, but the doctrine's well-rooted, correct?
Implied preemption has been around for many, many years, and certainly judges, the federal judiciary is well equipped to decide the scope of it, and that's what this litigation presents to your honors.
Is the federal judiciary well equipped to decide whether the foreign policy interests of the United States are in favor or against civil liability in a situation like this?
No, Your Honor. On this, that's why you would look to the United States itself to speak. And here, of course, the United States has not intervened, has not spoken.
Garamondi, the United States had repeatedly spoken, both in terms of executive settlement agreements and in terms of Deputy Secretary Eisenstadt's letters.
Yes, Your Honor. And when you look through the cases in which the Boyle Doctrine has been applied, if you keep going back to its purpose, which is to benefit the United States, the courts have repeatedly held that the best way to determine what benefits the United States is to listen to the United States.
Why didn't the court do that in Jernig, where the United States submitted a statement of interest saying that the Oregon statute would not interfere with foreign policy? And the court said, well, we conclude, despite that, that the Oregon law is preempted as a matter of foreign affairs preemption.
Your Honor, in this particular case, there's absolutely no reason for this court to go and do something that's contrary to what the executive itself has decided to do. So unlike that case,
the executive hasn't said anything either way.
That's not actually accurate. The executive has made a series of proclamations that bear directly on the facts here. They have said that the abuse at Abu Ghraib was not authorized, was not something that was at the behest of the United States. They have said that the war in Iraq should be governed by the Geneva Conventions and by the law of war. And in addition, they have spoken in Rasul v. Myers, they did not invoke the political question doctrine. So we have a series of different actions and silences.
Didn't the Congress, in the wake of Sosa and Abu Ghraib, in the Military Commissions Act, specifically say in Section 5 that no claim shall be brought based on the Geneva Conventions in any court?
Your Honor, that the passage of the Military Commissions Act is after the events at issue here.
Right, and I'm saying we're talking about the national government speaking to the issue here, and you just said the executive has spoken about the Geneva Conventions. Well, there's a valid statute that was passed by Congress in the wake of all this, specifically saying that no person shall be able to bring a claim based on the Geneva Convention.
And that's, Your Honor, why we are not pressing a direct federal claim based on the Geneva Conventions being self-executing. Rather, what we are saying is you need to permit the state tort law to go forward because it does not conflict with the federal rules that govern here. So it's a difference.
Why don't we have a statute here that is more specific than that which was in Boyle?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not understanding your question.
Why is it we do not have a statutory exemption here that is even more specific than what was true in Boyle?
Well, the statutory exemption that you're looking at here, combatant activities exemption, is as broad as the discretionary. And so it's really for the court to give the substance to that.
I'm sure. My sense is it's broader in a way in this respect. It precludes claims that arise out of the combat activities of the Army, Navy, or Coast Guard. It doesn't say claims against the Army, Navy, or Coast Guard. It says those that arise out of, right?
And, Your Honor, if you think about the interest that serves, it.
No, I'm not. I'm just looking at, you know, I'm just.
Right. The language.
I'm a country judge. I just look at the language first.
I think the language is broad.
That language arising out of is used in various other statutes, like, for instance, workmen's compensation statutes,
right,
the Longshore and Harbor Workers Act. And it has been interpreted by the court to mean only a connection to.
Right.
So why in this case isn't there a clear connection between the actions of the defendant and the combat activities of the Army?
There is, Your Honor. It's not that the connection is not there. The real question is not the breadth of the combatant activities exception, which is broad and is designed to protect the sovereign. The real linkage that's missing here is why it is that holding a private party liable would contradict that sovereign interest.
Why does the statute says doesn't limit itself to actions against the Army, Navy, or Coast Guard? It precludes claims that arise out of combat activities of the Army, Navy, or Coast Guard.
But it's a preservation of the sovereign immunity, so it's carving out
of course, but it's designed to preserve sovereign immunity, but if it is broader, you see it's broader than the discretionary function exemption, which really does relate directly to the government and required the court to do some sort of creative thinking to get to the private contractor. But here the exact language of the exemption applies to the private contractor because this is a claim that arises out of the combat activities.
Well, no, Your Honor, the language itself does not apply directly to the contractor. What it says is that it is a broad exemption, and it would certainly protect...
It doesn't say, you understand, it doesn't say a claim against the Army, Navy, or Coast Guard that arises out of combat activities. It says any claim that arises out of combat activities.
But that is not so broad that it immunizes all...
What you're groping for here is that this is an exception to the liability section of the FTCA, which only applies to actions against the United States, and which in another section specifically says not contractors.
Yep.
So it is true, no one in this room, I suspect, doubts that this combatant exception is broader than the discretionary function exception. That is the very reason the defendants are using it. But the only question is whether it has to do with liability actions against contractors as compared to the United States. And the FTCA could not be more expressed by itself on the question of what it applies to. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is the point where in trying to determine whether the private contractor should fall within that zone, you have to look at whether or not their actions...
Judge Silberman is asking a much narrower question.
Yes.
He's asking you a textualist question. And he's saying that this appears to be broader and cover not just employees, but broader. And it is true that as an exception, it could do that, but it is an exception to the text of the statute, which specifically applies only to, quote, claims against the United States. So if you were being just a textualist, you could not rely on this statute. You have to be a non-textualist. You have to be somebody who doesn't just read the words of the statute in order to get to the position the defendants want here. Now, that could be based on a preemption doctrine. But you can't do it just on the text of the statute. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so what the district court did is, unmoored from the statute, try to put the corporate contractors into the zone where they should, by implied preemption, be entitled to that. And our argument here is that when you look at whether or not they should be moved into that zone, you have to look at the United States' interests. And the United States' interests are expressed in the contract with the parties, as well as in all of the other evidence from the executive. And there, because it was unlawful activity that breached the contract, they should not be entitled to stand in the shoes of the sovereign for the purposes of the FTCA exemption.
Actually, in response to your dialogue with Judge Garland, he makes an excellent point. Of course, Boyle has already established the proposition that the exemptions in the FTCA can extend to the government contractor. So you have in this situation a broader linguistic basis for describing the context in which the tort exemption applies, but you still have to consider the Boyle analysis to which it does extend the exemption to the private contractor if it interferes with the same policy that preserves the suit against the federal government.
And the breadth of the exception...
Let me take a hypothetical. Suppose the Department of Agriculture had people in Baghdad, and a firefight developed, and the Department of Agriculture people happened to have weapons. They were authorized for one reason or other to have weapons. They were not involved in the Army in any way, but because of the firefight, they actually engaged in some firefighting themselves, and a lawsuit against them was brought afterwards. It would be clear, would it not, that arose out of the combat activities, and it wouldn't matter that it wasn't the Army, Navy, or Air Force?
Yes, Your Honor, but the breadth of the language of the exemption doesn't speak to how broadly you should make federal common law on the implied preemption. That's a separate task that really is divorced from the breadth of the exemption in the FTCA itself. So the one does not lead you to say, well, because that's broader language.
It doesn't lead you. You get a bigger step off with this exemption than you get with a discretionary function exemption. But you're correct. You still have to look at the Boyle analysis.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is why you constantly have to go back to, is it really benefiting the United States? And because of the unlawful nature of the conduct here that actually disgraced the United States and brought harm to the United States, it's a tough argument to make that what they were doing benefited the United States. I see my
On the implied preemption question, we were talking about how to interpret congressional silence, and there's a statement in the Crosby case, which is in this line that I wanted to read you and get your reaction, where the court said a failure to provide for preemption expressly may reflect nothing more than the settled character of implied preemption doctrine that courts will dependably apply. And it cited the Hines case, which is the original case in the immigration context in this line. Isn't that relevant to how we interpret what you talk about, the congressional silence here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but this is not a matter of settled law at all. There is no clear-cut line of cases.
There's a settled implied preemption doctrine that applies to certain areas of federal interest, correct?
There is indeed some settled law on implied preemption. The scope of that does not cover this particular case.
Wouldn't wartime activity be at the height of an situation where we would expect a uniquely federal interest, even more so than immigration?
It does not actually change the analysis, because in wartime particularly, you want to make sure that you do not extend the preemption to things that harm the United States war making.
You've talked many times about harming the United States, and I would think in the constitutional system we have that it's up to the Congress and the executive to determine what harms the United States in wartime.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is
it's not up to the states. I mean, California may not prefer the Iraq war and could enact all sorts of regulations of contractors in Iraq. Would those all be permissible?
Your Honor, my point was that as judges making federal common law, you have to continue to be moored to the underpinning of why you're making the common law. And the Boyle Doctrine of federal common law is a doctrine created by judges in order to make sure that we protect the sovereign. So my point is you cannot simply kind of claim a whole category is so broad, the war making is so broad, that any private party who has some claims against another private party, if it's in the zone of a war or touches on a war, is somehow outside of these courts.
Can I ask one more question, which is reparations for wartime misdeeds are usually negotiated by nation states at the end of the hostilities. The restatement refers to that. History is replete with examples of that. If states could regulate wartime activities, wouldn't that interfere with the federal United States government ability to negotiate such agreements at the conclusion of wars?
Your Honor, that's not what's at issue here, though. What's at issue here is whether or not particular individuals who were harmed by private parties can recover under tort law. The notion of whether or not the United States may see fit to give some broader group of people reparations is simply not before the court. We're dealing with a small subset of people who had the misfortune to be abused while they were detained. This is not the entire population of those who were detained. So if the United States going forward wants to make some sort of reparations for mistaken detention, you know, that's a different issue that's just not presented here.
One last thing. On the executive interest, which you've also talked about, the contractors here were potentially subject to criminal liability, correct?
The military, General Taguba's investigation referred the matter to the Department of Justice.
And the contractors are potentially subject to criminal liability, correct?
That's correct.
Under the War Crimes Act or the
Yes.
Torture Act. So the executive has the ability to state its interest to investigate this matter and to prosecute if it so determines.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, that the fact that they have not intervened despite working with us on the lawsuit really speaks to their view as to whether or not permitting the suit to go forward helps or hurts their interests.
Counsel, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the exclusive operational control standard which the district judge articulated, but do you wish to hold that until you come back as on the Salek case, I mean on the CACI case?
Whichever you prefer, Your Honor. I'm happy to address it now.
I'm not, well, here's a concern that I have. In the district judge standard that he applied is to provide a motion for summary judgment based on evidence establishing that in the Titan case, there was exclusive operational control of the contractor by the military.
Correct.
Whereas in, is it CACI?
Yes, CACI.
It was not exclusive, particularly because one individual testified that he could complain to the contractor about abuses. That was the major issue that Judge Robertson focused on to suggest the contractor was not under the exclusive operational control of the military. Isn't that correct?
It was even a bit more than that, Your Honor. It was that there was an on-site supervisor who testified that he could and would stop any kind of abuse going on, and if a CACI employee disobeyed his directions, he would fire them.
Okay.
So you had corporate control.
Fine. Isn't it true that if a American soldier is directed to engage in abusive tactics toward a prisoner, that's an unlawful order, and the American soldier has a right to, indeed an obligation, to disobey the order?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So this is exactly the same standard that would apply to the government contractor in this case.
And the government contract,
that's correct? It's exactly the same.
Your Honor.
Would it be perverse and inconsistent with Boyle's reasoning on economic analysis, wouldn't it be perverse to come out with a conclusion that if a government contractor integrated into the mission of the military asserts the authority to complain about abusive behavior, the same kind of authority that an American soldier would have, that authority now imposes liability? So then that would create an economic incentive in the future for the government contractor to say, I'm not allowed to complain if there's abuse.
Well, Your Honor, it's a bit...
That doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, it's a bit different than that. It actually is a tort incentive to make sure that they prevent the abuse. So when you look at what would best serve...
They have the authority to prevent the abuse, they're liable.
Yes, because then
So if they assert authority to prevent the abuse, bango, you're liable.
And if you think about it...
That doesn't sound like normal incentives for tort law.
But it is, because you want both the military and the corporate contractors to be working towards the same goal.
But they're under the... we just articulated, it doesn't matter what the contract says. They're under the same law anyway, because the military would have to object to orders to engage in torture.
Yes, but there's several differences between being a soldier and being a contractor.
Which are?
Well, contractor, if they're given an unlawful order, they can just walk away. They can quit. These are at-will employees.
And
so the
soldier's given an unlawful order, what is he supposed to do?
The soldier has a much more difficult situation because if they simply leave Iraq, they are facing criminal prosecution. So
they're facing criminal prosecution if they engage in an unlawful order.
Yes, Your Honor.
If they refuse and say, I will not carry out that order because it's unlawful, they are, under our law, sanctioned. They are entitled to take that position.
And, Your Honor, but for tort liability, the contractor would not be similarly situated to that soldier who's being sanctioned, because the corporation that does not stop their employees from participating in the abuse basically reaps the benefits of the contract, of the financial contract, and yet has not lived up to the duty to stop the abuse that's contrary to the United States' interests.
But under the district judge theory, if the contractor does not have authority to object to the abuse, he's not liable. But if he does have authority to object to the abuse, he is liable.
Well, Your Honor, I do think...
That doesn't make any sense.
I do think the district court test created a perverse incentive. And I think the way that it did so was immunizing Titan from liability when its conduct was contrary to the law and to the contract. So I would agree with Your Honor that it is the test itself creates a perverse incentive.
I was just wondering whether you weren't shortchanging your case when you agreed with Judge Silberman that the only evidence you had was some testimony on the subject. I thought that the principal evidence you have is the Army Field Manual and the Army Regulations, and in the Titan case, the contract, all of which say that the Army does not supervise these people, that they are not within the chain of command, and that it is the contractor's responsibility to do the supervision. Isn't that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So it's
and
not just a small dispute about two different pieces of testimony about how much there is. The Army has a position on this. The Army's position is it is the obligation of the contractor and not the Army to supervise these people. Isn't that right?
You're right, Your Honor. And I was responding to his characterization of what the district court relied on. And even that was broader than Your Honor's recitation of it. But yes, in addition to what the district court relied on, there's ample other evidence in the record that supports the proposition that the contractors are obliged to do the supervision.
Can I ask you a couple questions? Because you have an ATS claim as well, right? And an area that may be even more difficult to figure out than implied preemption. But on reading SOSA, it seems to me there's lots of statements in SOSA about judicial restraint, judicial caution, whether Congress has acted in the field. The court says that Congress may shut the door explicitly or implicitly by treaties or statutes that occupy the field. Similar question that I had on the implied preemption. With Congress having acted so much in the last 20 years in this area with the TVPA, the War Crimes Act, the Torture Criminal Statute, extending the UCMJ, why would a court, in the face of all that congressional action, create an international law-based cause of action to supplement that, given SOSA's direction to judicial restraint?
Well, and I think the answer to that really is you have to look at this particular case. I think that Congress did not legislate against American involvement in torture, likely because it did not anticipate that. But when you look at the status of international law, and you're looking for what is.
You don't think Congress anticipated that foreign prisoners could sue American officials in tort?
I do not think that Congress anticipated the events of Abu Ghraib. No, I do not.
No, I didn't ask that.
And that, you know, that's the question really being presented here. So when we look at whether or not to imply a federal common law under ATS, if, in fact, a district court's ruling that Titan was so under the exclusive command and control of the military that it was, in a sense, acting as the military, then I think you do have, you have brought yourself within the zone of ATS because you have that color of authority. If that is overruled, as we hope, then I think the only remaining ATS claim that has that level of concreteness that SOSA requires is the war crimes claim.
And what about private actors acting under color of state law?
On the private actors acting under color.
Isn't that something? I mean, our own case law on this preserves Judge Edwards' position in Tel Orin, which was left two possibilities, which the district court recognized. One was a private actor committing a war crime, and the second is a private actor acting under color of state law. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in SOSA, the Supreme Court expressly also said that there is room for federal common law here. It did not cut it off, and it again expressly cited Judge Edwards' opinion in Tel Orin. So this is a hard area, but this is an area that the district court only said one thing, which was that our case law has precluded this. And I take it your position is one thing, that our case law does not preclude this. And it's up to the district court to develop this question and find out. I mean, maybe it'll solve the problem. We won't have to face this because maybe there was no war crime here. Maybe the facts are not the facts that you raise. Maybe these people were not involved. Maybe it was somebody else who was involved. But subject to that, I'm not seeing how our own precedent or Tel Orin cuts this off. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're correct, Your Honor. And the analysis of the color of authority is one that I do think is intermeshed with the analysis that the court undertook. And so, in a sense, going the path of federal common law under ATS would certainly forward all of the interests that Judge Kavanaugh had raised previously. So I believe that either under federal common law or under state tort law, you reach the same result, which is that this isn't these are actionable claims.
Aren't your positions inconsistent? On the one hand, you're arguing that the contractors are independent of the military for purposes of the Federal Tort Claims Act. And for purpose of ATS, you're arguing they're acting under color of law?
Your Honor, that really speaks to the question of the color of law. It's like a cloak that's put over them. When they are with the military, working in with some, like, for example, Charles Grainer, who's now serving time in Leavenworth, when they're together with Charles Grainer beating somebody up, that they are being cloaked with the color of the law, even though, in fact, it is unlawful. So it is...
Even if they are not subject to... supervision, even if they're not in the chain of command,
yes,
they can still be under color of law, just like for purposes of 14th Amendment, private actors can be that, even though they are not subject to that level of supervision.
Do you like Judge Garland's answer?
Yes, I do.
But I got another answer for you.
Right, before you give us another answer, I have another question for you. You may, perhaps you could answer first before Judge Garland. If the exemption to the Federal Tort Claims Act is properly read as, number one, the exemption with respect to combat activities is even broader than the discretionary, for this case, broader than the discretionary decision exemption, but it's added to with the Boyle factor that extends it to the contractor. Doesn't that analysis preclude the ATS liability?
If the federal common law is held impliedly to preempt.
Yes.
Well, you know, Your Honor, the implied preemption speaks to whether or not you're intruding on the sovereign right by letting state tort law go forward. So to let federal common law go forward under the ATS would not raise the same issues at all. You do not need to preempt the federal common law applying to the sovereign.
That's a very interesting point, but actually there's another doctrine in the labor field where preemption has been interpreted to apply not just to state law but also to federal law. Under the National Labor Relations Act. Indeed, this court once wrote an opinion holding a executive order of President Clinton's unconstitutional on the grounds that it was preempted by federal common law, federal statutory law.
Well, but,
the point is, so preemption can apply to both state and federal under certain circumstances. All my point being is that this common law notion, which is drawn from the writings of law professors, not the most reliable way to base your law. But in any event, that's sort of drawn from that.
Right.
Runs counter
to... speaking as a law professor, by the way.
Yes, I am. Runs counter to a statutory interpretation of arising out of combat activities, which adds a Boyle factor to get to the contractor who is integrated in the mission. If that statutory interpretation plus the common law is correct, how the devil can ATS stand against it?
Because the statutory interpretation is on its own. Then you have the federal common law that's implying the preemption. But if under ATS, the international standards become the federal common law, under Charming Betsy, you couldn't interpret that preemption in a way that conflicts with the international law that's now federal common law via the ATS.
I understand your argument, but it seems to me it runs more against congressional intent than would otherwise be so.
And the congressional intent, though, has spoken to the sovereign, not to the private parties.
But the sovereign's interests are the same here as it was in Boyle. In fact, it's even stronger.
But the real
analysis... Here we've got people who are integrated in to the military mission. So they're even more... the sovereign's interest is even greater than would be true with a Sikorsky aircraft or a helicopter manufacturer.
But the sovereign's interest vis-a-vis the contractors is for the contractors to live up to the sovereign's expectations. And so the sovereign's interests are furthered by holding the contractors to the contract, not to letting them act in an extra contractual.
As you point out, the sovereign hasn't sought to do so, as far as we can tell.
Well, in fact, Titan gave money back for the conduct, and that's in the record.
But anyway, the point is that we don't have any litigation before us in which the sovereign is seeking to proceed against the contractors or their individual employees, either civil or criminal.
Nor has the sovereign spoken in this case.
The sovereign is silent.
The sovereign has been silent, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question about your statement that the political branches couldn't have anticipated tort suits of this kind against the government or government contractors? In the SOSA brief in the Ninth Circuit, which was two administrations ago, so this is March of 2000, the Justice Department Clinton administration said, in pursuit of its legitimate foreign policy objectives, the United States occasionally may take actions that some would say violate its international obligations. In plaintiff's view, any alien is entitled to complain of such conduct in federal court under Section 1350. Such a rule might render actionable efforts by the United States and those acting on its behalf to pursue its legitimate foreign policy aims, such as U.S. attacks on Osama bin Laden's facilities in response to the African embassy bombings, etc. The alien, and this is the key, the alien tort statute is not intended as a vehicle for U.S. courts to judge the lawfulness of U.S. government actions abroad in defense of national security, and any remedies for such actions are appropriately matters for resolution by the political branches, not the courts. So it seems like it was quite well anticipated that there would be ATS claims against the U.S. or those acting on behalf of the U.S. government.
But, Your Honor, the situation here is not that. I mean, we are not confronting a case in which the contractors engaged in the conduct at Abu Ghraib for the benefit of the United States. So we're not looking at the United States' conduct or its agents' conduct.
Obviously, when you define it that narrowly, but in terms of the interrogation and translation services that are being provided, those are on behalf of the U.S. military, correct?
But those services are not at issue here. This is not a case about the way in which interrogation occurred. This is a case about, you know, stacking people up in pyramids naked.
Right, and so assume, obviously, war crimes, but there's a war crimes criminal statute. The question is whether there's also an implied cause of action under the ATS against U.S. Officials acting on U.S. behalf in wartime.
But it's not against U.S. officials acting on the United States' behalf. So if you look at it in the context of a soldier that co-conspired, say Charles Grainer that co-conspired, what would happen if you sued him in his individual capacity? It would not automatically be deemed a suit against the United States. There would have to be the Westfall analysis, and the sovereign would have to speak. So what they are actually asking for is to be elevated to a position above that of their co-conspiring military people. And when you think about the military's anticipation of how these cases should be handled.
Can you repeat that above that? Because I thought the military officials would have sovereign immunity.
The military officials would have sovereign immunity if the sovereign spoke and said they should. The sovereign has not spoken and said these people.
Or even if a court independently determined that it was within the scope of employment.
And, you know, that analysis turns again on, does the conduct benefit the United States? And if you look at the military's own structure under the Foreign Claims Act, they clearly expect that claimants who have a claim that's primarily the responsibility of the contractor to go after the contractor. And that's in the Army Regulation 2720. So I think what you want to refrain from doing is upsetting the apple cart that is cabined in by the Army regulations and the law, and that is what the military expected when they brought people like this into the mix. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Zimmelman. Zimmelman, sorry. Should ask for pronunciations beforehand.
May it please the court, my name is Ari Zimmelman of Williams & Connolly on behalf of the Titan Corporation, now known as L3 Services, Inc. Judge Robertson applied the Boyle analysis to find the tort regulation of Titan supervision of its linguists would conflict with uniquely federal interests and is preempted. The linguists provided by Titan to be embedded in units engaged in combatant activities filled a critical gap, a crucial gap in the fighting force that was essential to the military's ability to engage, conduct wartime operations in Iraq.
Can I ask you, when you started out with Boyle, so Boyle is not the clearest explanation of how it got to the result, but it seems to me that one way to read Boyle is that there is an entire section that comes before the FTCA analysis. And in that section, the court asks whether there's a significant conflict between state law and a federal policy, and then gives a specific example where there would be and where there wouldn't be, which is the helicopter hypothetical, which is not completely hypothetical. And it says, if, for example, a federal procurement orders, officer orders by model number a quantity of stock helicopters that happen to be equipped with escape hatches opening outward, the problem, that being a problem, it is impossible to say the government has a significant interest in that particular feature. And then it goes on. And so it says, so first we find that that's not this case, they say. In this case, there was a conflict. And then they go on to look for what they call a limiting principle, and they look to the FTCA. But it seems like the first question that has to be asked, even independent of the FTC, is whether the FTCA is whether there's a conflict here. And since the government didn't order the interrogators to do these things, or at least no one in the government has claimed that the government did this, and the plaintiffs claim that this is, except I understand there's a dispute in the Khaki case, in the Saleh case, I guess, with their RICO claim. But with, at least with respect to the Ibrahim plaintiffs, they claim that this is a conspiracy, private conspiracy, between the interrogators, the linguists, and rogue soldiers. Under those circumstances, why do we even get to the FTCA claim?
I think, Your Honor, that the Boyle analysis actually proceeded a little bit differently than you articulated.
Temporally, in terms of the opinion.
Because the opinion
clearly doesn't get to the FTCA until it first finds a conflict.
Well, Your Honor, it certainly first finds that there's a uniquely federal interest in the liability of independent contractors performing the government's work. And it found that interest in the context of military procurement contract for military equipment during peacetime.
But it found, it says the present case is the opposite. Here the state-imposed duty of care, the asserted basis of the contractor's liability, is precisely contrary to the duty imposed by the government contract, which is to equip it with a specific kind of escape hatch.
But I think at that point, Your Honor, they moved from the analysis to the analysis to the specific case that was in front of them and applying that analysis to those facts. The analysis, I would submit, Your Honor, in Boyle was they established that it was a uniquely federal interest in terms of the liability of independent contractors supplying the military, in that case, with equipment. I would submit that that uniquely federal interest is certainly present here where
they found a specific conflict between the contract at issue in that case and tort law. That is because the contract asked for a specific kind of escape hatch, and this contract doesn't ask for torture or anything else.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the conflict they found in Boyle was between state tort regulation of the contractor and the government's interest in getting the government's work done, and that the facts of those cases focused on the design, as because it was a design defect case, focused on the design and the source of the design. The analysis I would submit is that they looked to the exemptions in the FTCA to find the outlines of the conflict.
I understand. So your view then is that the exemptions are what provide the outline of the conflict.
Certainly in that case and in this one, Your Honor.
So why are we even messing with the combat exemption? Why don't you jump directly to the foreign country exemption and just say whenever contractors act in foreign countries, they're immune?
Well,
in every case, whether they're in chain of command or not, whenever they're hired by the government and they act in a foreign country, they're immune.
It would certainly, in this case, dispose of these claims to do so. I would submit, Your Honor, that the policy under that the issue, as discussed in SOSA, of the policy behind the foreign country exception, in terms of subjecting the United States to foreign law regulation, is different than the policy as identified by Judge Silberman in terms of preempting and excluding all claims arising out of the combatant activities of the military.
So let me pause over that. So I understand, your position is not that every exception of the FTCA is a source of conflict, and you would not say that the foreign country exception is a source of conflict because the policies are different there. Is that right?
I would submit, Your Honor, that issue hasn't been developed in this case.
Right, but I need to know, because what we decide today about one, depending on how it's worded, could obviously affect the other. So just for the general principle, is the general principle that it the exceptions to the FTCA that define the outline of the conflict, or that we have to also look at how important those principles are?
I would submit, Your Honor, that it's not about how important the principles are. I would submit that the analysis set forth in Boyle is to look at the policy underlying the exemption in order to determine the outlines of the conflict between.
But looking at the policy underlying, and that is not what courts usually do in statutory interpretation. Why shouldn't we take Boyle as a given for the discretionary function exemption, and beyond that, follow the text of the statute and let Congress provide exemptions for contractors if it sees fit? The textualist approach, isn't it?
Your Honor, I submit that this is not exactly an exercise in statutory construction. We are not arguing.
Well, why not? There's a statute that provides exemptions for certain activities of the government, and it doesn't provide exemptions for contractors. Congress could easily do so.
But that was precisely the issue considered and decided in Boyle, Judge Kavanaugh, that looked to whether state tort regulation of the contractor, of Titan, would conflict with the federal interest in getting the government's work
done. You think
done.
Boyle then set the federal courts on a mission to do this kind of policy balancing, which is very difficult and we're not well equipped to do in all sorts of areas related to other exemptions in the FTCA?
I don't know about which case, you know, depending on the circumstances of the case, it is certainly the case here where you have a procurement of personnel to be embedded in military units engaged in combatant activities, that tort regulation of the contractor would, and basically through tort regulation, regulating how Titan supervises its employees, requiring Titan to embed supervisors in the military units.
Great policy arguments that Congress could address, right?
As been pointed out, Judge Kavanaugh, the issue is how to interpret congressional silence. I would submit against the backdrop of Boyle that it has never been held that state law should be allowed to regulate claims arising out of combatant activities.
I could just reword Judge Kavanaugh's question. Great policy that the executive could address, and in Boyle, the executive did. In Boyle, the executive filed an amicus saying that this would conflict. No one has done that in this case. So you're asking us to assume, because we're judges, we're apparently capable of doing that, what the policy interests of the United States are?
Your Honor, I'm not asking you to assume that. In Boyle, as far as we can determine, the United States only appeared when the issue reached the Supreme Court. They did not appear in the Fourth Circuit.
You could have asked them to appear here. Did you ask them?
We did not, Your Honor.
You didn't ask the Army? No one asked the Army or the Justice Department to consider appearing?
No, Your Honor, we did not make a request for them to appear.
They were well aware of this case, weren't they?
Certainly the Army litigation section was well aware of this case.
And they didn't file anything?
That would not have been up to the Army litigation
section. Well, they could have asked the Justice Department.
They would have had to go to the Justice Department and require them to make an appearance.
So how do we decide which is in the interests of the United States? So imagine you are Secretary of State and you're afraid that people around the world will stop cooperating with us if we don't provide liability for people who do this kind of behavior, if we don't provide civil liability. On the other hand, the Secretary of State might have the opposite view, maybe the Defense Department might have the opposite view, that it's very necessary to prevent just the kind of things you're talking about. How do we make that balance?
Your Honor, I don't think that is the proper balance that's being struck here. The balance in the case of the common law claims is whether you're going to subject Titan to state or Iraqi law regulation in terms of how it supervised the linguists.
State civil liability. What I'm asking is, you think it's unimaginable that the United States might think it would be helpful to its foreign policy to have these contractors subject to state civil liability? You think that's just unimaginable?
Your Honor, I think it is certainly not the express policy of the United States and is certainly contrary to the structure of committing the conduct of war and of not allowing state law regulation. It is state law regulation through the tort system.
But the regulation itself says that contractors can be subject to civil liability.
Which regulation, Your Honor?
The DFAS, the regulation that has been cited in both, that your opposing counsel expressly cited just a few minutes ago. I'll cite it for you if you want. But I'm
talking about the regulation or statute?
No, I'm talking about the Army's regulation.
Earlier talking about the statute.
No, I'm talking about the regulation. You know which regulation I'm talking about.
I'm not sure if you're talking about the comment in
response to the
question.
I'm not talking about
the
comment.
Okay.
I'm talking about the final rule itself, which the comment relates to, and that says, inappropriate use of force by contractor personnel authorized to accompany the U.S. Army forces can subject such persons to United States or host nation prosecution and civil liability.
Well, it certainly, in terms of civil, in terms of criminal prosecution,
civil
Your Honor,
I got the
in terms
part.
Of its civil liability, Your Honor, I think that if adopting the approach of the district court raises open the question, depending on the nature of the relationship between the contractor personnel and the military and combatant activities. It does not
so you're not going for the Garamendi preemption here. You're going, that is for field preemption. You're talking only about Boyle preemption. Is that right?
We are talking about Boyle preemption, Your Honor.
What if the United States filed a letter saying what I just said? What if the United States were to file a letter saying this would actually hurt our foreign policy? We don't want this exception. What would your position is it would make no difference, right?
Until there's been an act, until Congress has spoken, or until there's been some formal, if they had filed such a letter, and I would in fact find it surprising for them
but
to
if
file
they
such
did,
a letter.
Would you, well, you could always refer to the doctrine, if my aunt had wheels, she'd be a trolley car.
Yes, but I guess my question, which has little to do with trolley cars exactly, but does have to do with the question of who makes the policy here. If the Congress remains silent, and if the President or the Attorney General file a letter saying, you know, really, we think that the plaintiffs are right here with respect to the scope of this contractor
exemption. Isn't your argument that Congress hasn't remained silent, and as your interpretation of the Federal Tort Claims Act as interpreted by the Supreme Court in Boyle?
That
does mean that the Congress has not been silent?
That is correct, Your Honor, that they certainly have not been silent in terms of the—
And incidentally, in that respect, how do you treat the exemption which we have here as compared to the exemption in Boyle?
I believe within the subject matter of the combatant activities of the military, it is, as you pointed out, Judge Silberman, a much more sweeping and absolute prohibition against all claims arising out of, whereas the discretionary function exemption obviously has many limitations in the law and is narrowed, more narrow. It is clear to us, Your Honor, and I think to Judge Robertson, that the congressional intent here was to not allow claims of against contractors, to allow a state or foreign law to require contractors to exercise a certain level of supervision, embed supervisors in military units, that would in fact conflict with the general proposition that the military's claims arising out of the military's combatant activities should not proceed.
So in light of that, just so I'm clear, in light of that, it wouldn't matter what the executive branch said. Is that right?
Your Honor, again, if there was a clear statement by the executive branch in terms of civil liability for contractors, I would submit, Your Honor, that in determining federal common law preemption of state law claims, that should not determine the issue.
So it would not matter what the executive said. That's the bottom line, right? Because you put it in the best possible way. You said if there was a clear expression on exactly this point, it still shouldn't matter.
I guess I hesitate on the whether it should not matter at all or whether
it shouldn't determine preemption.
It should not determine
the court ignored the Justice Department statement in Jernig, of course.
That's correct, Your Honor. What
do we make of the fact that Congress, since 2001, since September 11th, has enacted statutes that have expressed government contractor defenses, for example, in the Safety Act, which was enacted in 2002? Doesn't that suggest Congress, again, aware of contractors, and then you put the DTA, the MCA, the extension of the UCMJ? Congress has been very active in this area, yet no action like the Safety Act to exempt contractors from liability.
Your Honor, again, when you're enacting a particular piece of legislation that you might want to, as Congress did, exempt contractors under a new piece of legislation. But this is not a new situation under Boyle. Under Boyle, it says that federal procurement contracts have a uniquely federal interest and that you look to the FTCA exemptions in order to determine the scope of state law conflict regulation. I would submit that you don't need any more of an express statement by Congress on this issue than what exists already. And as you pointed out, there is, in fact, there have been criminal legislation with regard to war crimes and foreign torture victim protections acts, none of which would create liability, civil liability, in this situation.
Do you think, by the way, that your employees could be criminally prosecuted for what they did then, not now, then? Are you in a position to concede that they are subject to criminal prosecution?
There certainly have been subject in this record, Your Honor. There have been a grand jury investigation as late as December of 2007. There have been an ongoing grand jury investigation of our employees.
Would you take the position that they could be prosecuted under this?
Without knowing what the facts of the particular case are and what about your company itself
for the charges raised in the complaint? Are you subject to criminal prosecution?
Your Honor, I'd have to understand for failure to supervise, Your Honor,
I thought you might want to do that. Let me ask you, I would like to ask the question that opposing counsel ended with, which has to do with the Westfall Act, is a question that's been troubling me as well. So if your client here were a soldier or an FBI agent, not a contractor, what would happen? Same claims, but soldiers or agents, FBI agents.
I submit, Your Honor, it's not directly analogous because the analogous question is what would happen if they sued the linguists as opposed to the corporation who provided the linguists.
Oh, all right. Let me start with that. I think that's a good point. That was my last question, but I'll use it first. That's a good point. So what about that? Do the linguists get the same protection here that you do?
It's a different issue, Your Honor. I would say.
I know. If it were the same issue, I would know what your answer
is. I understand. if they were not able to avail themselves of preemption, if as a matter of law, if this court held that the interest in regulating the individuals through tort law regulation was different than the corporation, and I don't think it is. But if you held that preemption was available to the corporation but not to the individuals, then the individuals, I would submit, could in fact seek protection under the Westfall Act because based on the record established below, they were acting as agents of the government, and they would be able to argue that
even though they're not government employees.
That is correct, because the Westfall Act applies not just to employees but to governmental agents, and agency, the rules of law of agency governs that determination, which comes back to what Judge Robertson did here, which is evaluating their day-to-day, who was in control of their day-to-day performance.
So your underlying position is that they should get the same protection as the corporation, otherwise they might not like they might not want to work for you, in which case that would raise your prices in order to attract people, and that would then raise prices for the government, and that would also interfere with the war effort. Is that your position?
I think those are some of the reasons. I think there are other reasons, as articulated by Judge Robertson as well, as to why you would not want to subject them to state tort law regulation.
So in all those cases, though, if they were actually FBI agents or soldiers, there would have to be a Westfall filing by the government, or there would have to be a Westfall filing by the government, or there would have to be a de novo decision by the court.
That they were acting within the scope of their authority.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the soldiers, you are asking for something more than the soldiers would get. They would first have to get this Westfall certificate, and which we would view deferentially. If they had to go without a Westfall certificate, we'd have to view this less deferentially. But you're asking to be able to go forward without even asking the government. In other words, this would force the government to address the question, which they have not addressed today, whether you're within the scope.
In the question of whether they would be substituted as a party in the litigation, the Westfall Act does require them to speak as to whether these employees were acting within the scope of their duties. I don't believe
that
we are—
The court can independently do that as well.
And the court would then have an independent determination, whatever answer the government said, about whether they were, in fact, acting within the scope of their duties.
There aren't many cases, I assume, where the government has said you're not acting within the scope and the court has said you are. Am I wrong about that?
I believe that that's correct. I have not done a count, Your Honor. I can't answer that. But it is certainly the case, Your Honor, that on these types of facts here, which is allegations of abuse in the context of detention and interrogation decisions, this court has held that that was within the scope of authority of the employees at that point.
Okay,
so it is
ask you about one of those cases. So in the Razul case, we said the plaintiffs concede that the torture, threats, physical and psychological abuse inflicted on them, which were allegedly approved, implemented, supervised, and condoned by the defendants, were intended as interrogation techniques. And then goes on to say, while the plaintiffs challenge the methods that the defendants used to perform their duties, the plaintiffs do not allege that the defendants acted as rogue officials or employees who implemented a policy of torture for reasons unrelated to the gathering of intelligence. At least with respect to the Ibrahim claims here, their claim is exactly that, that these are war criminals, that they are acting, that they acted not for information collection, but to harass and punish. That sounds like in Razul we're leaving open the possibility that scope of employment might not include every kind of torture committed by a contractor or even a government employee. Is that wrong?
I think Razul might have left open that question. Obviously, that question wasn't before the Razul court, and so I don't know.
In other cases, interpreting D.C. law, because of course we have to interpret the state's scope of employment law, which varies from state to state. But in interpreting D.C. law, we summarized the law, I think, in Harbury after Razul, and it had issue. We summarized our law, which has said that sexual harassment, shooting a customer, rape, all fell within the scope of employment. And then we dropped a footnote to explain the oddity of that law, and the oddity of the law is based on you want to. D.C. law is designed so that you can recover from the deep pocket employer rather than from the usually judgment-proof person who actually committed the offense. So scope of employment law is defined under D.C. law in a way that doesn't really fit with the terms of the words and what you usually think about as scope of employment.
So that's right. My only question about that is whether this is one step further. That is, I appreciate you don't agree on the facts, but unfortunately for purposes of this argument, we're assuming that real war crimes were committed here. Now, what if the government were to say, yes, there are a lot of bad things that our employees can do that we're going to say are within the scope of employment, but this is just over the edge. That is, this is a direct violation of both our own law and these are war crimes to torture people for not to get information, not in pursuit of any lawful objective. President Bush, in his press conference on Abu Ghraib, could not have been clearer in saying this hurts the United States, this is against our policy, This is against the interests of the United States. So why would it be leave aside what the government might take as a position in general about a contractor liability. You think it's unimaginable that the government could take the position that this kind of behavior is outside the scope of employment of our contractors?
Your Honor, I think that question doesn't hit on the issue as in terms of Titan's liability. Obviously, if the linguists were acting outside the scope of their employment, Titan would have no liability at that point. And so under your hypothetical, Titan wouldn't have any liability either. And so the question here is, assuming they're acting within the scope of employment, are you going to subject Titan to state tort law regulation for the alleged actions of its linguists that are embedded in combat to provide support, fill critical military billets? And I would submit, Your Honor, that the analysis in Boyle makes clear, as well as the constitutional allocation of responsibilities for the conduct of war, as well as all the other issues we've discussed, makes clear that Titan should not be submitted to that.
Plaintiffs don't get anything if you're not within the scope of employment. So,
well,
they don't get anything. So
that's correct, because
they have to argue in order to win that it is within the scope of employment.
That is correct.
This hypothetical gets them nowhere.
That is correct, Your Honor.
How about, can we turn to ATS?
I've got one more set of questions about Boyle. So what about these Army regulations, contractors accompanying the force, and the Army manual, contractors on the battlefield? Seemed quite express about supervision being the obligation of the contractor, and about the employees not being in the chain of command of the Army. What about that?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. I think in the first answer, that what matters for the analysis of preemption here is what actually happened.
Why? That's what I know that has to be your answer, but I'm just wondering, why is it? Why does it not matter if the Army's carefully considered regulations say that management of contractor activities is accomplished through the responsible contracting organization, not the chain of command? Commanders do not have direct control. Only contractors manage, supervise, and give directions to their employees, which is this statement is, it must be clearly understood that contractors do not have direct control over contractor employees. Only contractors manage and supervise their employees. It's repeated over and over again. Why, if this is the considered decision of the Army, as expressed in two official documents, why is that less important or unimportant as compared to what actually happened on the ground?
Because, Your Honor, the question again is whether to submit Titan to state tort regulation for these claims would conflict with the interest expressed in the combatant activities exception. And I submit that in a situation here where the record shows that the day-to-day activities of the linguists who were embedded in these military units were under the control of the military, and where the testimony from the highest echelons of the executive to Congress was that the military was, in fact, in control of the performance of their duties, that is what matters.
How do you explain, which is implicit in Judge Garland's question, the divergence between the contract and the practice?
Your Honor,
the contract, but the contract also, but the regulations.
Well, again, because this is on summary judgment, I think the meaning of the contract is certainly as implemented in Iraq is that the supervision that was provided was administrative supervision.
That's what I thought you would say.
What about the meaning of the regulations?
And the meaning
we hardly
of the
ever look at the way people actually behave to determine the meaning of a regulation issued by a government agency.
But again, Your Honor, in order to determine whether these claims should be preempted against Titan should be preempted, I would submit that here the interest, the policy interest, requires you to look at what actually happened on the battlefield. And in terms of my explanation, it is obviously to a certain degree speculation, but war, the history of this contract, certainly, I can't speak to the regulations, the history of this contract was that it was done well before the conflict in Iraq. You had a situation where you had an incredible military need, and in essence, the operational commanders decided on how they were going to employ these linguists and how they were going to control these linguists. And that was supported consistently, certainly by the Army, in terms of the number of site managers that were approved for this contract. And again, I don't think the factual record shows that it was, in fact, the Army that was giving these people day-to-day instructions on how they performed their duty.
On the ATS claim,
yes,
SOSA seems to say that international law claims that are sufficiently universally recognized and definite can be recognized by the federal courts. Why isn't war crimes, which has been recognized, private commission of war crimes, which has been recognized at least since Nuremberg, one of those norms that should be applied by the federal courts?
Your Honor, first of all, I think the outcome here is controlled by Sanchez-Espinoza and would require where war crimes were, in fact,
assume it's presented. Not.
Assuming that it is not, Your Honor, I disagree with your hypothetical, your question a little bit in terms of the characterization. War crimes, as we briefed, may not require state action, that is, and may allow for private individuals, but it does require the presence of a belligerent. In order to have a war crime, you must have a belligerent, which in this case is the United States. And I submit that that brings you squarely within the reasoning of Sanchez-Espinoza, that to allow those claims to proceed, where implicit in the claim is that you were acting on behalf of a belligerent, you would trench on the sovereign immunity of the United States. That is, I submit, the holding of Sanchez-Espinoza. I believe that it would in fact control the outcome, and nothing in SOSA, which talked at length about the prudential requirements to limit the scope.
Can't you read SOSA to talk about those prudential cautionary notes to be the setup to the ultimate test that SOSA sets forth? And the ultimate test, after going through those various factors requiring caution, is universal recognition and sufficient definiteness.
But it's universal recognition of the nature of the claim as well. And I would – the footnote 20, which talks about whether state action is required, I think it's noteworthy that they talk about that you need official action for torture, and that the one claim in CADIC, which is genocide, the one claim which is universally understood not to require a state or a belligerent that is detached from that, is the only thing that showed up in that parenthetical.
Well, war crimes is correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that had been universally recognized and long recognized as being a state actor or a private actor could be liable for war crimes.
Again, Your Honor, in the Nuremberg case, it goes back to the Nuremberg cases, yeah. As you say, there was no question that the war crimes at issue there were, in fact, involved Nazi Germany, which was a state. And therefore, the issue for private liability had to do with whether you were going to extend the foreign sovereign immunity, the comity considerations.
What about
to
war
the
crimes
actor.
Committed by a contractor acting for the belligerent?
I would submit, Your Honor, to where that belligerent is the United States, that runs squarely within the concerns expressed in Sanchez-Espinoza that
SOSA carved out in footnote 21, for example, a couple of exceptions to the rule that they had set forth, but it didn't carve out something that suggested an exception for U.S. officials in wartime or U.S. contractors in wartime. It wouldn't have had to do the former because of sovereign immunity, but it didn't do the latter either.
And that issue, this issue has not really come up in the cases, Your Honor. This is the first time, I believe, where the belligerent is the United States, other than in Sanchez-Espinoza, where the
– Certainly it could have been anticipated, as I read earlier from the Ninth Circuit brief in SOSA years before, and that's actually repeated in the Solicitor General's brief at the Supreme Court level, the possibility of extending ATS liability against U.S. officials was part of the mix.
And that issue never was never addressed and never considered, and I would submit doesn't change the holding of Sanchez-Espinoza or the rationale behind Sanchez-Espinoza, which is one should not imply an action against contractors where the belligerent, where it is in fact the United States as an essential actor in the underlying claim. We also submit, Your Honor, alternative grounds.
The text of the ATS doesn't distinguish among the United States as defendants from foreign defendants, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. But the ATS...
Would customary international law, obviously, distinguish between the home state, the home country versus foreign countries in terms of whether the norm is to be recognized in the home country's courts?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor.
Every nation, not every, lots of nations have sovereign immunity that may make it a hollow promise, this customary international law.
And as a matter of federal common law, Your Honor, I do think that considering whether these acts were conducted in the context of a prison in a war zone, in a U.S. war zone controlled by the U.S. military, should inform whether you should imply a cause of action. We also submit, Your Honor, that corporations are not liable under the ATS for the reasons we've advanced in our brief, and that if one were to...
There's a whole slew of cases out there. Are they all wrong? Everyone's missing the boat on that?
I would submit, Your Honor, that none of them have considered the issues, have considered the holding in Malesko and its relationship after Sosa to whether you would imply a federal common law claim against a corporation. Moreover, Your Honor, I would submit that the special factors analysis would apply to this claim where the United States is the belligerent and is the state actor on behalf of this conduct is alleged to have occurred.
Can I just ask this on the ATS?
Let me just one thing. You're talking about the factors in Sosa.
No, Your Honor. Well, the special factors analysis.
You're talking about like a Bivens special factor. You're talking about Bivens special factors
analysis? The Bivens special factors analysis, Your Honor.
On the point about Espinoza, I'm not really exactly clear about it. What aspect of that makes you think that a suit against a private actor can't be brought, even if the United States is the belligerent?
Because it would trench on the sovereign immunities of the United States no differently than if they were acting, because the actions of the United States are essential to the underlying claim.
I'm looking for the holding in Sanchez-Espinoza that gets you there.
The holding, Your Honor, is that there were claims for war crimes and for torture, and what then Judge Scalia held was that whether these people were acting as private actors or as state actors, those claims failed. That is the holding of Sanchez-Espinoza.
Well, right, and did it hold with respect to whether these are war crimes or not? What was alleged? Was that considered in the case? The allegations in that case are not the same as the allegations here, right?
Well, the factual allegations are of torture and of rape and are of assault.
They're not extrajudicial killing. Yes, but they're not treatment of prisoners, or are they? They're not the war crime.
I don't
of
believe
torturing
it's...
prisoners of war.
And I would submit, Your Honor, that I don't see why one would draw a distinction between what kind of war crime one is alleging, and I don't know that one can tell based on the Pellet decision whether these torts were committed against prisoners or not.
Okay, thank you.
If there's no further questions, for all the reasons we've addressed here and set forth in our brief, we request that you affirm the judgment of the district.